Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It had probably lost 55-60% of its value after a year.
We want a cash figure, really.
probably it lost over 30 grand. And
hello and welcome to episode 17 of the Collecting Addicts podcast. Before we started recording, Manish quite beautifully said, that's one third of a year. I've never done anything for a third of a year. I've never had a job for a third of a year. I've never actually had a job. Anyhow, more important matters, the Miami Grand Prix, a shit show or a piece of foresight that has to be defined as genius? What do you think, Neil Clifford?
Oh, it's a very complicated one, isn't it? Because I just want anyone else to win apart from Max. So it's really annoying, isn't it? I hope Manish is going to give us some numbers about viewing and how, you know, that would be great. Because even though it seems as though the world is talking about F1, actually less people, I think, are watching it. Manish, you'll give us the data. But I just want Ferrari to do better. I want Mercedes to do better. I just desperately want someone else to win more than Max. And I think he's going to win every race. My prediction of Lewis was shocking. I'm embarrassed about that. You know, you can get a $500 burger, which I'm sure we're going to talk about. You know, it was all a bit sort of NFL final, wasn't it? It was all a bit too cheesy, really, for our love of old school F1. And please, who can sort out Ferrari? Shouldn't they just control, alt, delete the whole thing? Shouldn't they just get rid of the drivers, get Lewis in, get Lando in? It'd be so exciting, wouldn't it, Ferrari would be better? I'm so pissed off that Ferrari are doing badly. Even if Mercedes and Lewis can't get eight, let's at least get a Ferrari win mixed in there somewhere.
I can't disagree with any of that, I have to say. Although some of our Dutch viewers won't like us, but we're not anti-Max.
Coming for you. No, we're not anti-Max, but he's hard to love.
Yeah, I think Manish share that same problem. We're difficult to like. Manish, what are your thoughts here? I know that you've got some empirical evidence of what's been going on between the two Miami Grand Prix.
Well, the ABC brackets, ESPN viewing figures came out yesterday. Nielsen said that the race was watched by, I think it was 1.96 million people. Sorry, 1.6 million people. ABC said, no, that doesn't include streaming. So it was watched by 1.96 million people. But the fact is, last year's race was watched by 2.6 million people. So the best estimates tell you the viewing figures are down 600,000. That's not 600,000 down from 17.6 million to 17. That's 600,000 from 2.6 to 2. Any way you look at that, And, you know, you can go around saying, well, don't worry, it will all make up for itself in Las Vegas. But it's kind of not the point, is it? And I suppose I've got two big concerns about Formula One. And they are starting to actually hit me in the pit of my stomach now, which is that I think it's really important to get the younger generation in. I don't think Bernie was right in saying to drivers, you can't have social media, you shouldn't be. I think that would have been an absolutely positive move. My slight worry is if you really want to go after a new crowd at the expense of the satisfaction of the old crowd, I think you have a problem there. And I mean, I'd just liken the Grand Prix to this. A lot of people said it was a bad race. I absolutely don't agree. We had Max out of position. We had Lewis out of position. We actually had drivers who were overtaking, and it wasn't all DRS. You know, there was some beauty. We see that lovely triple move that that Max made. Max did, on Leclerc, and it was Magnussen, wasn't it?
Only because he had another 500 horsepower down the straight.
Right, though. A billion horsepower. It's just such a lovely move. And, it, you know, things like that are exciting. But there, were, I'd liken it to this. When you go to see a rock concert, if you want to go and see the Rolling Stones, you normally have reasonably appropriate warm-up acts, okay? But what you don't go and do is you don't go and see the Rolling Stones and maybe have take that as the warm-up act. And what it does is just puts you in the wrong frame of mind for when a Grand Prix starts. And I'm now talking obviously about the complete build-up. I mean, it doesn't matter what the menus were and how much it was to get a burger there. I wasn't at the Grand Prix. But what I did feel was that the razzmatazz before was for the sake of razzmatazz. There was no sort of sporting predication. And I mean, look, you know, you think Bernie Ecclestone is great mates with Eric Clapton. He's great mates with Mick Jagger. He's great mates with all of those. He could have put one of those on any time he wanted in the last 40 years. But I think he had some instinct saying, you know what, this is actually going to take away from what you're about to watch, because actually Mick or Hugh Grant or somebody like that could probably nuke, in terms of charisma, all the drivers at the time, including probably Senna, actually. And I think that's where the judgment comes in with this. And, you know, my final and sort of slightly also depressing passing thought is this, that in 2021, under the old rules, we had a championship. You know, there was some kind of equivalency, not just between Red Bull and Mercedes, but Ferrari had the odd shout as well. And I think, you know, what have you got now? You now have probably one of the most unequal championships. I mean, in five races, Red Bull have won all five. In fact, you see the statistic, apart from Perez's fifth place, four of them are 1-2s. We're talking about sort of Williams domination from 1992, but for the second year. And who created the rules? You know, this one has got to be slightly wholly owned by the people who own the business, who promote the business. And listen, I have no problem with any of this, except I just, you know, I'm feeling slightly less and less, and it may just be a product of my age, but I'm feeling slightly less and less at home with each of these races. And if we find that the young people spike and all of that is actually due to COVID, not due to the fact that, you know, it's been so brilliantly packaged. Because I don't understand how you can say we've got exponential growth in the sport, yet at the same time, the viewing figures are down that much. In the second year, you'd have thought, and there was no NBA match, by the way, there was nothing competing for that time slot. Mm. You know, so basically you can turn on and watch a Grand Prix and it's, you know, America should have been watching.
Yeah. Are they down in Europe, Manish, figures?
I'm sorry?
Are the viewing figures in Europe similar?
I haven't seen it yet. I normally check motorsport broadcasting for that, so I don't know what they are. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised, but I think the thing that everybody points at is, look at the viewing figures in America. That is a massive economy. If we can get that economy into Formula One, everything is going to be better. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I've got a very, very, I don't know if you saw, somebody posted on social media, these two women who are obviously not Max Verstappen fans. I don't know if you've seen it. Somebody actually took a shot. So Max lines up on his grid and they're giving him the bird. You know, are just literally giving him the both of them. And then, you know, and it's this isn't 3 seconds. This is about 2 minutes of this. And the Red Bull mechanics are being actually very funny and kind of smiling at them. But I mean, I sort of am into Formula One because I wasn't a football fan.
I didn't. I'm not sure George Russell. I'm not sure George Russell would thank you for referring to him as two women. But I think we get your point. Chris Cooper, I can just see you're hopping from cheek to cheek, desperate to contribute your thoughts.
I thought we'd adjusted the camera angle so we couldn't see that. But,
I want to say.
You know how much I love deconflating and unpacking stuff.
Yes.
That's why it says challenge above the door.
It's why it says challenge above the door. Oh, those were the days. So I agree with Manish. I think actually the track and the race wasn't bad. There was, on Friday and Saturday, they couldn't help themselves from throwing it at the wall. Red cars more than most. And I really worry about where Ferrari's at and what's going on in Charles' head, because on the Sunday, he clearly looked, and to me as a driver, not in his class clearly, but you know, as somebody who's, before Monkey Says, chucked it at the scenery on regular intervals.
He has.
There comes a point when you do that and you think, I got to stop being an idiot. And immediately after that, you can feel, what am I doing? I'm driving.
When are you planning on having that epiphany yourself, Chris? Sorry, just to let us know.
No, you know, there have been moments when I've had that epiphany. And so I can sort of, I have a lot of sympathy for him. The track was good. There were, the going down the back straight, you could see him thinking, oh, hang on a minute. If I overtake here, I'm going to get done by the guy on that wiggle before and through the start finish straight. There's a couple of times when people said, oh, I'm going to hang back. It's just like the racing we've done, Monkey, and Caterham's and stuff like that. That was really good to watch. The fact there wasn't a single yellow flag on Sunday, I mean, that's just amazing. These guys are gladiators and the heroes. And that kind of takes me to my first point about the razzmatazz. I actually quite like the razzmatazz. My concern about it was they didn't do it very well. And if you're going to do it, it was an interesting juxtaposition with the coronation the previous day. It's often been said that nobody overdoes understatement quite like the British. And the Americans on Sunday kind of underdid overstatement, did it the wrong way around. They cocked it up.
Yeah,
that tent that the drivers came out of. They must have hired that from B&Q, whatever the local version of that was, that morning, thinking, oh shit, we need a tent for them to walk out of. Can somebody go and get a gazebo from somewhere? It looked really, really incompetent. And I think, and everyone's seen it, and we were texting about it at the time. To see at the end of the pit straight, as they're all about to come on or coming on, there's a little rope. And on the side of the rope, there are celebs, including Roger Federer. And the other side, there's Jackie bloody Stewart. Sir Jackie Stewart. And to see Sir Jackie, and when I was talking about with my boys last night, thinking who else is left from the 60s, has won races, is still around. I think it's Jackie Stewart, Jackie Ickx. Mario's still around, but I don't think he won races in F1 in the 60s, in the 70s. So there's two of them left from that era, that extraordinary era where most of them died young. He is the legend. He is, to use the overworked phrase, the royalty of our sport. And to see him being manhandled by, I mean, Martin made a really good joke of it, and I think George tried to come to his rescue as well, and then tried to find Roger. But to see Jackie Stewart manhandled, you think, how badly wrong have you got it? So if they did it properly, I'm not offended by the razzmatazz. I think that would work quite well, because these guys are heroes. For the rest of it,
I was worried, Chris, that they were going to taser him.
I mean, it was just horrific. I mean, and I hope that Greg Maffei and Stefano would have looked at that and said, how badly did we get it? It's like seeing stuff on YouTube of police officers doing bad things in the street. It's like, it's that bad. It's that bad.
His Rolex mate Federer should have helped him out a bit.
Yeah, you'd think there'd been some Rolex sort of, you know, but
the Rolex guys should have been there.
On the race itself and what's going on right now, you know, there's a danger we'll have short memories, and we are all optimistic and positive. And I guess I'd say to my colleagues, for the purpose of benefit of everyone listening, that in three races time, we've got three European races on quite different circuits coming up, three weekends back to back. I'm hugely excited. We're going to have three weekends back to back races, Imola, Monaco, Barcelona, all the way around. They're all different. They'll all be really good. Bit of rain thrown in. Hopefully, we won't worry so much about where Max is at and so forth. I do worry about Ferrari. Mm. I probably worry even more about where McLaren's at. Rossi, who's the head of Alpine, made some very, very strident comments about they're not doing a good enough job.
He referred to them as amateurish at times, didn't he?
Amateurish at times. And if you, many people will have seen...
That was about, it was about this podcast rather than the Alpine, wasn't it? Yeah.
No, it wasn't. No, he was very positive.
Most of the time.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think there's we'll have more to look forward to. And I think, you know, everything tells us that at the start of new rules, like in 14, the start of the hybrid rules, Mercedes, largely with their engine, suddenly launched ahead. With the ground effect rules, Red Bull are clearly sorted. As rules mature, everything sort of narrows and tends to the same point. So my hope is it will only get closer because the headroom for Red Bull is lower than everybody else's. This year, maybe not showing so far. So I remain optimistic. I think if we're going to have the razzmatazz, do it properly and celebrate our heroes, because these guys are heroes.
Who's the new bloke at McLaren coming in?
Gilles de Ferret.
Gilles de Ferret. He's a lovely bloke. A
huge Brazilian, good friend of Senna's.
Yeah, lovely bloke.
But he's there as a consultant, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's there to suss it out for the Bahrainis to see why it's so shit, is it?
Well, maybe not. I think he's there on behalf of Zach, isn't he, to look at to try and create this new structure within the team. I want to say thank you to Chris for his wise words there, and also some very expressive pen work, which was interesting. He really was Tony Blairing it with the pen, and the beats were hitting nicely. You're a natural percussionist. Now, Edward Lovett, who's sitting in a room with a floral decoration somewhere near Epinay, having had a skinful last night. What did you think of the Formula One? Formula One, by the way, is racing in cars.
Oh, fine. Thank you for reminding me of that. Well, I think Neil made a good point the other day, which was that if Red Bull do go and win the championship, which is obviously going to happen, then are we all going to be tuning in at the end of the season? Now, you Formula One hardcore nutcases will be, but I think Neil and I will probably struggle a little bit more. And we'll be holding on to things like pictures of menus with fruit salads for $350 and trying to understand why it all got so out of hand. We talked last week about Monaco being sort of the spectacle of Formula One. We know the racing there's rubbish, but it sort of has this sort of stigma, so this aura around it. And having been to Monaco, not paying, but I just love the fact that the fans can arrive in Monaco early in the morning and find a position up on the bank with their probably jambon beurre and watch the Grand Prix for nothing as pure fans. And Miami, from what I understand, you know, four seats, $4,000, $350 for a fruit salad. You know, they're doing everything they can to not allow the pure fan to be there. Yes, we can watch on TV, but it seems like a massive change. We also did a podcast 12 months ago, Chris, when we talked about the obvious shift when they did the Miami Grand Prix last year, where Brundle was walking down doing the grid walk, and they all just ignored him. No one wanted any of his time, and it was sort of almost funny last year, and actually just made it feel like this is an American sport now. But you know, as Manish said, you know, they really built it up this time. But you know, the racing was fine, but it didn't really live up to the razzmatazz of the start. So yeah, they've really, you know, we're talking about a very smart company here, so I'm sure they're going to find some way of turning it around and learning from their mistakes. But yeah, progress is not in their favor at the moment.
I was disappointed. Sorry, manager. I was disappointed in some respect to see on Will I Am's jacket that there was actually seemed to be some free space left on his jacket.
It did.
Even more logos.
Maybe that was for his nascent car design company.
I hope so.
He's a budding automotive designer, isn't he? Can you imagine?
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking forward to that.
But like a Suzuki X90 that had been shat out by a a Jaguar 420G. Right, here we go.
Do you not? I was going to say, just on the Will I Am point, it's a tiny point, but there's a sort of metaphor here for having a very small classical band being conducted by Will.i.am in a kind of pseudo-classical style for drivers that are being brought in by LL Cool J. And if that was an omelette, I'm not sure I'd eat it, if that makes sense. There's so much going on here. And Edward, I'm not sure. I mean, yeah, of course, Liberty, a financially very smart company, a very, very smart media company. You know, Greg Maffei is an MBA from Harvard Business School. He was also a Baker Scholar. He was at Dartmouth before that. So, you know, talking about Ivy League. But for me, if you pull too many levers at once, and I'll just tell you this with my, I used to be a bit of a scientist when I was a medical student hat on. The whole point about science is it teaches you, change one variable, observe what happens, try to work out what's going on, then see if you can replicate it, then change another variable. And a bit like governments that make lots and lots of promises using the word change, you can actually end up by pulling too many levers simultaneously.
Yeah,
totally. You produce a pudding that you don't really understand. And, you know, there's no doubt Formula One needs to reach a younger audience. We are not it. I've got a very finite kind of amount of time left on Earth. But you know what I mean. The point is that, you know, of course teenagers should be into Formula One. Of course we've got to find a way. And, you know, history's littered with men in their 50s not understanding their boys and girls. I get that. And I think it's really important that it does find a way to do it. It just seems to me that this is a kind of regional way to do it. I'm not sure there are so many Dutch kids or Spanish kids or French kids or German kids or English kids who are responding to the stuff outside what the drivers are doing. And I just go back and say it. I think the drivers, with much more freedom with social media, with the ability to tell their own stories away from the track, I think in a way that could well have been enough.
Right, I've got some stuff written down here, partly in response to what you said and to some thoughts from the race very quickly. I'll read out my top line words I've written down. The Ferrari drivers, Stroll, LL Cool J, driver preparation, Jackie Stewart, McLaren, De Vries, and the pit walk. I'll explain those. The Ferrari drivers, I'm worried about Ferrari's team. I'm massively worried about the drivers. Leclerc made a couple of really big errors and clearly lost confidence in the car. So his incident in qualifying quite clearly meant that he didn't have the confidence in the car. I think there was definitely an issue going on with the tyre compound and that new surface. The track was very green. It was rubbering in quickly. I mean, if you've raced, when you're not quite sure of what's underneath you, it's very difficult to explain to people, but you can't commit. And if you only put 99% into a corner rather than 100 and everyone else is putting 100 in, you're bollocks from the start. So yeah. I have sympathy. but Carlos made a massive mistake in the race coming into the pits. You know, they are judged on tiny decisions they make and it's a high pressure job, but he got a 5-second penalty for coming in too hot into the pits. And the moment he did that, his head went as well.
Yeah,
he was fucked. So if you were team principal Ferrari, you'd have to say, we love you, but you're not as good as the other guys at the moment. You know, that's harsh, but they're making more mistakes, I think, than the other drivers on the grid. And that has to be addressed. I think they're both great personalities and real talents, but they're making mistakes. LL Cool J, I echo exactly what Manish and Chris have said. I'm a huge fan. You know, every girl of my generation thought he was the sexiest man ever born. He's a great rapper. But what does he represent? He's not hitting the young generation. He's a rapper from the late 80s, early 90s. So the young generation that have come in on Drive to Survive probably wouldn't have a fucking clue who he is. It was a really weird decision. You know, get someone young in, but he's sort of hybrid, not young. I don't know what he was representing. I'm a huge fan. That I don't need to reiterate the fact that whole lead up thing was utterly cringeworthy. And also for me, it wasn't cringeworthy in the way that you could laugh at it. Martin's grid walk, sadly, is being reduced to the kind of thing where you just go, oh, I can't watch this. Him hunting about, trying to find someone. I love the grid walk. I think it's one of the greatest pieces of sports broadcasting of the last 30 years, but it might have had its day. I think just because he's struggling to get to people. I don't want to see my hero, Martin Brundle, being ignored by Z-listers. It's not a good aesthetic, I don't know. Jackie Stewart, I mean, if I was going to play devil's advocate, is it possible to make sure that every single one of your security staff at an American sporting event knows who Jackie Stewart is? I mean, I don't know. I think...
Isn't there a badge problem there? There's a straight badge problem. I mean, could have done to give you an identifier that gave him all areas.
But I have to play devil's advocate. You know, the number of times... I once was late for a studio recording of Top Gear because I went outside for a smoke and a wee, and the security guard wouldn't let me back into the studio. And I was there going, I'm a presenter. And he went, pull the other one, mate. And I was, it's like Jeremy bloke. He's like, no, I'm the new brown one that no one watches, but I'm still a presenter. I couldn't get into my own studio. So shit happens, you know, it just happens. McLaren, I don't know what to say. Bless them. It looks like there might need to be some changes there. They're really struggling. And it is, isn't it so sad to see, but also what we're used to in Formula One, you've got someone like Lando who's just been the fresh thing, the new thing that we love for three or four seasons, and now the shoulders are down, the body language is different. It's just I don't like seeing it, but that's the gladiatorial part of the sport, isn't it? We're voyeuristic, we're watching these people's careers do this. De Vries, bless him. I feel so sorry for him.
Yeah,
he's clearly a mega talent, but is it worth, if you were coaching, if Neil Clifford was coaching De Vries in the Saturday morning under eights in the Football League, he'd probably say, Nick, have 10 minutes on the bench, collect your thoughts, and we'll bring you on second half. That's what you'd say, isn't it, Neil?
Yes, it would, yeah.
Yeah. And last but not least, Chris Cooper said the word Imola. And I just want, in the next three races, Imola is the next race, isn't it? And yeah. I want to just say that I love Imola. Sad things have happened at Imola, but if you've ever driven there, it is a proper race circuit. It's got everything. It's got topography. It's got history. It's everything that Miami isn't. And I've got a funny feeling that when we arrive in Imola, we might all just breathe a sigh of relief. I might not care if Max runs off into the distance because we're back at a proper Formula One circuit.
Yeah, I went last year with my son. It's a really brilliant weekend.
Totally. Yeah. It's a natural amphitheatre. And when you walk on the circuit, which I've done, and you just look up these sheer green slopes and these farmhouses dotted above you, it is just the most beautiful circuit in the world ever.
That language manages to be so exotic
in
describing such ordinary things. Because if at Donington you had a corner called Buxton Spring, you just wouldn't like it too much. But Aqua Minerale is gorgeous. You know, I'm not having Buxton Spring, thanks, but I'm having
Variante Alta, Variante Bassa, Tamburello. Yes, you know,
So we're back in the land of the living. Now, we're moving into a personal area here. Some of us might have been more affected by this than others. Not that I have the right to ask people, but I suggested it might be interesting if we discussed the worst depreciation we've ever suffered on a new vehicle. It could be a used vehicle, I suppose, but actually, really, it should be a new vehicle. And I'm gonna go over to my friend Chris Cooper, who for a long time I think made some of the most unwise new car buying decisions of anyone I know. So, Chris, how bad did it get?
Well, I only make unwise new car buying decisions until very, very recently, as Neil observed. So, kids, this may be a shock and surprise. We've all grown up in a world where when you bought a car, generally speaking, it went down in value. And in the last few years, post-COVID and supply chain, all those kind of things, some witchcraft and witchery has been going on. And you could buy a new car, and suddenly when you bought it and it was used and abused, people wanted it more than they did the new car and were prepared to pay more for it. Go figure. So our experiences, and I have to say, this does feel like a category that's invented for Neil, because he must, simply by sheer dint of numbers, be able to trump all of us. But I think the worst one, you know, we talked about Alpina. I love Alpina. The second one I had was about 10 years ago. There was a E92. B3 Touring, that silver grey one I had.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I was very, very pleased when I bought it because it was the only one in the UK. And I felt so pleased with myself.
That's how Alpine is sold. It's always the only one in the UK.
Well, we did a bit of checking.
Go to Guildford and you see the other three.
When I sold it, a number of people came to me to say who you sold it to, because we're trying to find one and there isn't one. But only when I came to sell it did you realize if you've got only one of something, it might be to do with the fact nobody else wanted one when they were new. And the chance of somebody wanting a slightly abused, had done 150 miles an hour, whatever it was, down some autobahn on the way to the Nürburgring, that might not increase its appeal. So they were quite reasonably priced. I bought it He'd been in the dealership at Nottingham for about 9 months in 2008 into 2009. And the
Alpina sales... Just give us the numbers, Cooper. Stop the narrative. Give us the numbers. Come on.
So it probably lost... When I sold it after a year, it had probably lost 55, 60% of its value after a year.
We want a cash figure, really.
probably it lost over 30 grand. And to make it worse, when I saw it for sale, and the salesman at Alpina in High Wycombe was a lovely chap, and I won't name him, but Mark. He's a lovely chap. And when I saw it for sale, so, you know, everyone sells a car. You always I wonder how much they're selling it for. And I think I sold it for about 30 grand, and it was on sale for about 40 grand. And I thought, that's just twisting the knife, that is.
Did so, you yeah. also have that moment where you thought, 40 grand, that's good value, I might have that?
No, not after not having come from where I come with it. No,
I would have bought it back.
Well, I've tried a number of times. I tried because I saw it about a year later for 25 grand, and I thought, no, I have actually bought back a car. I remember that I had an E63 wagon that I sold after 2 years, and it went into the Mercedes system, and I had a pang of guilt about it. So I found out where it was for sale. The Salisbury dealer had it, and I went down there, and I didn't say who I was. And he went to get the paperwork, and you could see him didn't walk across the showroom. As he walked across the showroom, he sort of looked at his paper, looked up at me, looked down, said, I don't understand. This used to be your car. I said, yes, it did. But I don't understand. You sold it. Yes. And I thought, there are some, they just don't understand why we do daft things. That's my worst depreciation.
To use Manish's rock concert analogy, I feel that some of us here are just fluffing and we're not the main event. And I'd normally wait till the end for the big band to come on, but I'm going to go second because Neil Clifford he's the big band here.
I'm the biggest dickhead on the chat today. Well, let's
I reckon I know what yours is, Neil.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. Let's get straight to the numbers. Buying a car for £330,000.
Good spec, that. Good spec.
Yeah. And selling it, I think, 7-8 months later for £205,000. So a loss, I think, it was about £115,000. And I did 2,000 miles in the car. And the calculation, we can all maybe guess what this car is. The calculation was it cost me £57 a mile in depreciation.
And it's probably now worth 350 grand.
I don't think it is, actually. They, at the time, and obviously this involves our friend Matthew at the best Ferrari dealership in Europe, Dick Lovett, Swindon. And he rang me and said, oh, you've got to have this car. I know you, the joke of it is I'm so stupid. I already owned an FF. So I already had the best one anyway. But no, there was this new fabulous car that was a GTC 4 Lusso. Yes. And the dash is so much better because it's got Apple Play. Which, of course, for £1,000, you can put Apple Play into an FF. Which I then did and saved myself £114,000. But I suppose, as always with these things, I was probably after the F12 TDF Cappuccino Spider in manual. There was only going to make five of them. And Matthew had sort of said, it's quite possible, you know, if you can make Ferrari happy, back at base. And you know, up your, you just need to update your
make it seriously now.
Database, keep your database up to date. And I ordered it in silver with tan. And my wife, when it arrived, she's like, "We've already got one of those. You've got a green one. Why do you want a silver one?" She's not going to know that Manzoni has fucked up the design and made it uglier than the one I already had.
Yeah.
But anyway. Yes, I don't think anyone...
I would say in your defence, Neil, as someone who did lots of miles in an FF, I never owned a Lusso because I couldn't afford to. I now know why. Because the rear wheel arch wells produce a lot less noise than a Lusso, so it's a quieter car to sit in the rear
of. It's a quieter car, which in my view is not good. I like the sound of an FF. I mean, it's probably one of the best sounding Ferrari's full stop, isn't it? And I bought the FF from Matthew, and actually I've done 30,000 miles in an FF. You know, I adore that car. I'll be buried in that car. This was a car I bought before green was cool, before Make Green Great Again on Instagram existed.
Yeah.
It was a car that was owned by a senior diplomat of the Nigerian embassy in London that walked into HRO and said, can you make me an FF the colour of the Nigerian flag? This is all true. So it's green with tan with yellow calipers. And there was an election in Nigeria, and his mate lost. So he had to leg it back within 24 hours.
I just knew this was coming.
He dumped the FF at Dick Lovett in Swindon with four curbed wheels. And I went and bought it. So I had the cool car anyway. Well, I bought another one that looked exactly the same but worse, just because it had CarPlay. But anyway,
I need to clarify one thing.
I remember the depreciation was £1,000 a week. Matthew said, if you don't move quick, it will be beginning with a one.
We ought to have Matthew on here one week. Just to explain himself.
The problem is he's quite busy delivering prostate examinations to his best clients at the moment. I need to clarify one thing there, because we don't live normal lives necessarily, the five of us. We're very privileged and we're very lucky. And we're giggling about losing sums of money that are life-changing to many people. But to be clear, you know, we've all made money on cars as well. And I think the reason why we can giggle at losing some is that we make some. And if life was just full of losing sums of money like that, A, we'd be distraught, and B, we'd be so skint, we wouldn't be doing this. So I think we have to, you know, it is a serious business, but you have to take the rough with the smooth. Let's hear some more about the rough, Edward Lovers.
Are we ever going to give up on this Alpina B5 for
It was a disgraceful piece of trading.
I actually wrote down here, I'm a car dealer, so I can't lose money on cars, but I'm not a very good car dealer, if I'm honest with you. And I've lived a couple of times in LA, and I've sort of moved my family out there. And one of the things I've done, which is absolutely foolish, but I do it anyway, because I sort of see myself as a non-car dealer when I'm going out there. I think, right, I need to order a car. I need to order a new car. So I'm going to make friends with the local Porsche dealer. You know, they're just as fucking bad there as they are here, because, you know, you've got to flirt with them all the time, which I just hate doing with car dealers.
We know the feeling.
Yeah, but I also... So I did order a...
Did he really just say that?
What's that? Yeah, I do. Yeah, I'll add some more context to that later. Anyway, I ordered... And the rules in California are kind of weird. And for obviously all of you Americans who are listening know this, but in the UK, for a brand new car, you have an RRP, a recommended retail price. And throughout most of the world, you have to stick as a dealer to that. In America, they don't give a flying fuck about those rules. So they have a window sticker, which has the spec and all the emissions and the price. And then a handwritten note in the windscreen says market adjusted price. Mm-hmm. And they just put whatever fucking number they want on there. And, you know, they order the cars for stock as a dealer, put $150,000 on top of them, and then just hope there's some idiot that walks in and buys them. There's plenty of idiots that are happy to do that. You would never get away with that in the UK. You'd lose your franchise like that. But the other rules in California are kind of weird. So until you've signed the paperwork and driven, even if you've paid the full price for the car, until you've signed the paperwork and driven that car off the lot as a new car, you can get your money back. So it's kind of this song and dance. So once you've paid for it, you still need to go through, you know, they could effectively sell the car to someone else until you've signed the paperwork and driven off. So anyway, cut a long story short, I bought a Ford Mustang GT 350R, which I think they were, Chris, you'll need to remind, I think there was something like $65,000 or something like that.
I bought a picture of yours somewhere.
Yeah, I bought the first one in LA and I paid $100,000 for it. And all the cars advertised were like $150,000 or something like that. So I went and picked it up the dealer was just the nastiest guy in the fucking world, but I really wanted the car. It was jet black, no stripes, and I wanted it. And I was going to Malibu the next day for cars and coffee. Nice. And I went and picked it up. I think most of my teeth fell out driving it from LA to Malibu cars and coffee, because it's the ride on it is absolutely terrible. And on the way back, I decided to just flip up the canyons and do a few loops. And I've got to say, for a big old beast, that car in the twisties is bloody brilliant.
Topanga Canyon.
Just amazing. Anyway, I took the car home. So I must have done 150 miles in total by now. And then we decided we didn't want to live in LA anymore. So we decided to leave. And what I hadn't factored in when I bought it, obviously knowing that the dealer that I bought it off was a total fucking shyster, obviously I paid sales tax. So I paid whatever it is in LA, 9% sales tax. So you don't get that back. And then you need to leave it on sale or return because you don't want to take a check for it. So you go and you don't want to give it to the Ford dealer. So you give it to someone you thought was a friend to say, look, do us a deal, you know. 5 months later, he still has the bloody car. And I took about $76,000 back for it and 150 miles. So I don't know what the maths are, Neil, but it's probably worse. At least you had some smiles per mile in the FF.
That's a similar ratio of fuck up, I think.
Yeah.
He was so careful
buying a car in California.
He was so desperate to get rid of it. He kept trying to sell it to me.
I did try and sell it to you.
I don't even live over there. Yeah, but you go over there a lot. Wouldn't it be good if you had a Mustang GT50 when you're over there? Not really, no. Manish, because you've been much more sensible than us, I suspect and I hope you don't have a horror story, so you might regale us with a third-party story.
Oh, my God, you read my mind. 15 years ago, I was walking around the... it was the motor fair, and it was... I can't remember where they have it now. It's in East End, isn't it? And we went upstairs. I was with a friend who absolutely loves cars. And we just spent the whole day together. And we went upstairs, and they had they had used cars for sale. And we were wandering around, and my eye was drawn to this absolutely beautiful, I think it was a late 80s Ferrari 328 in black, with black leather. It was so beautiful. This thing was just shining, and I sort of went up to it and I thought, God, I wonder how much this car costs. And I think, can you remember how much they were new? I mean, it can't have been too much change from sort of 60,000.
They'd have been about 38,000 or something.
£40,000.
So I go up to this car and I sort of did a kind of quadruple take, 6,995, okay? 6,995 pounds. We were just walking around trying to find rust or a hole or a wheel missing, or maybe it didn't have seats or a petrol tank. And then it just said underneath, only one owner since new. It had something like 30,000 miles on it, Keke Rosberg. And if there's someone who you do not want a car from, okay, who's driven it before, it's Keke Rosberg. You know that thing has been thrashed to within 1 centimeter of his life. And that, for me, that's Rosberg depreciation, whatever that is. £32,000 in a decade. Well done, Keke.
So on that theme, what's the Rolls Royce that Barry Sheen drove around the Nürburgring with Steve Parrish worth? That's got to be worth... It's probably negative money, isn't it? That must be so fucked.
Oh, Barry Sheen.
I have got some horror stories with depreciation from times when I really didn't have the money to support it. So some of it makes me feel guilty, and I can't really... I remember buying a new 997 Carrera from the Lovett family, thinking, oh, it's a first new Porsche, it's going to be great. And I was about a week into it thinking, I'm not really sure about this at all. It's not as nice as the press car I drove. It's got a load more creaks and rattles. I suspect they build the press cars a bit better. Can't really afford the finance. So again, I went to chop it in to a bloke called, and you won't believe this, Matthew Beard. He's there donning the prostate glove. And I think I did 2,000 miles, and it probably cost me £15,000-£20,000. And I've had loads of those. I've never had an absolute horror story. But the irony is, I'm sitting on one at the moment and I don't know how it's going to end. I've got the only Polestar 1 in the country, the £150,000 four-cylinder Volvo, which when you say it out loud, is one of the silliest things you could ever do. Now, I don't know what that car's worth. I love it. It's parked outside and I've no intention of shipping it on just yet, although I might have to because the old employment status is a bit variable. But I'm not sure what that's worth. But I think if I stuck it up on collecting cars, even if Neil Clifford was there with a very, very active bidding finger, it's not worth more than 80 grand, is it? I don't think. I can't believe it's... Is it worth 90,000? I don't know. But no. Even if I got 90,000 for it, that would be...
Just never sell it. Then you don't lose any money.
Exactly.
No, but I don't own it. The bank owns it. So my answer to this question is, I'm sitting on it at the moment and it's there lurking like a sort of fucking malignant tumour and I don't quite know what to do with it. So the best thing to do is go and drive it and enjoy it, which is what I'm doing.
Yeah.
The biggest loss you've made, Chris, is the gain you haven't made on a 993 GT2.
Don't mention the 993 GT2.
Well, I tell you what, I was going to say that your language has been too colourful today, but because you've definitely, you're nursing an Epinay-style hangover, you're being a bit loose, but I'm going to swear at you and say fuck off, because that was outrageous. I sold that for 100...
Don't mention Ed Singer, though.
Oh, this was different league, mate. I sold this for 130 grand. It's now worth 1.3 million quid.
Oh, that's true enough, yeah.
I've never had one of those. Right. So we've got through the horror stories. Let's move on to something more positive. And now we're going to sound really old. We're going to sound like a bunch of people that whinge that a rapist introduced Formula One drivers before a race. Because we're going to make a passionate defense of the use of a key in a car and how important the key is. There you go. Edward's got one there. Manish, do you like car keys or do you prefer a keyless life?
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
So I have a little teeny anecdote on why I would always prefer a car key. And this has nothing to do with your car being repeatedly ripped off. But I've got a very sweet neighbour and they've got a massive Jeep, which is keyless. They also have the cutest little labradoodle who's getting on, tiny thing. And she, on a very warm day, was kind of rushing around, put a labradoodle in the car, chucked the key onto the driver's seat, shut the door because she thought, oh, I've forgotten something. And the labradoodle smacked the key and locked itself in. So completely locked in, key sitting. And she realized she didn't have the spare key, her husband did. So she's got a labradoodle who's stuck in a car on a warm day, whining away, and she really didn't know whether to smash the window or call the police or whatever. Fortunately, we have a very nice little dealership where I get my car serviced around the corner. I found a bloke who looked a little bit like Parker from Thunderbirds and said, this is what this lady has done. He got something that looked like a blood pressure cuff out and a crowbar, and he came in. He managed to jimmy it a bit, got the blood pressure cuff in, pumped the thing up, opened it, managed to open it. And I thought, there is an advert now for keyless cars. And it's you could fry your dog unless you've got a crowbar of your own. So always keys, always keys. Also, that just that joy of doing this. You know?
Yeah. No, I think, Neil Clifford, you're someone who sends us videos of trying to coax many of your old crocs into life. And I think that if those videos didn't begin with you showing us the key and putting it into that little ignition barrel, it wouldn't be as romantic. Do you agree?
Well, it's our emotional connection to the car, isn't it? It's the thing that connects us to the car. So I adore keys. It's about the only thing I don't lose, actually. I don't think I've ever lost a car key. There's some sort of thing that keeps me. Yeah, I just store them in lovely places, and I adore the bloody things. I mean, two things on my mind. What is your favourite key? My favourite key has got to be the drilled hold 917 key, which you can go and buy those little blanks from a Porsche for, what, 69 to 74. So you can, I have one of those. So you've got a lovely little key for your Porsche, and it's even been made lightweight by lovely little holes drilled in it. But this keyless thing, I mean, it's a bit like, what's my analogy I was thinking about this morning? It is 5 a.m. in New York, so I'm a bit grey. It's like the smart motorway. Who the fuck thought it was a good idea?
Yeah.
Right? If someone's designed it that doesn't drive much on motorways or has got complete logic only and no fucking common sense, it's going to be okay because no one ever breaks down on a motorway. We just get rid of the hard shoulder. Yeah. And it's a bit like the keyless. Now you've got to go on Amazon, if you live in London, and buy those fucking black bags and put your key inside the black bag so the bloke doesn't show up at your doorstep with his laptop and nick your key through the letterbox. I mean, what's all that about? If you've got a Range Rover in central London, you can almost not insure it.
Yeah, just leave it open. Don't bother locking it.
Yeah, or I think Mercedes and BMW is bad because you can walk around with this piece of software on your laptop and you don't have to nick the keys through the coat hanger, through the letterbox, like in the olden days. At least you had to have some level of sort of, brains to nick a car. You just walk up to the front door and switch your laptop on. So whoever invented the keyless car basically needs to be dismissed from their job. Yeah.
Gone.
Is that how they work? Do they work on Bluetooth?
It's a scanner. They scan
the radio signal.
Frequency code, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think
it's terrible.
The analogy with smart motorways is, I think, is a really good one because at the heart of, and we
all
now
right,
know.
You, all right, you two, get a room. Come on.
No, it's a good
I've
one.
I've got a spare room here, actually. I'm
oh, thanks.
Own.
I'll be there. Yeah. Don't leave the door open. Well, smart motorways was
1405.
Thanks, pop it. Smart motorways. So the idea was somebody looked at the data, and this is where, and I know this is, you probably mostly worked out, and I run a management consulting business. That's kind of what my professional life has been. So I know how badly wrong management consultants can get this shit. So somebody looked at the data, and they looked at the data on smart motorways and said, number of car journeys, number of miles, number of breakdowns. It's obvious. We just need to provide spaces for number of breakdowns. What nobody did was to say, how does somebody behave when they need to stop? And the problem is, when you need to stop, you need to stop. Nobody looks at the signs or can remember the last sign to say, when was the last refuge? Did anyone remember the last sign we've just passed that said, is it half a mile, is it a mile? I haven't got a clue. I've got an emergency. I'm going to stop right here. So these dreadful, and it's awful and tragic. I'm so glad that the authorities have now reacted. They've all happened because people have not known, because it's not how people behave. And they've not got
one further question. What's that got to do with car keys?
Because it's the same problem.
Someone's invented something that no one fucking needed. That's what
it is. Because they looked at the data.
Let me take the piss out of him. He's making good, valid points and he's in a flow and it's my job to fucking interrupt it. Now, carry on.
I've spent 20 years with you usually in the back seat. Droning. Is that a droning noise?
Look, it was always funny. It was
is that a whining noise?
It was funnier in the back. You know that. Now, never. I want to hear your passion defense of...
Well, when I first saw... when I first saw this question, I thought, oh, my God, it's that funny crowd down in Bristol that have that big bowl on the sitting room table.
Oh, right.
We'll put the keys into that. Is that where we're going? Thankfully, turns out it's not. So I'm with everybody
else. That's my other podcast.
Okay. All right. Is that on
collecting
the dark
keys?
Collecting keys.
Collecting.
Sponsored by Finder's Fish Fingers. Right.
Collecting diseases. So, key is when you turn a key, you know how long do I have to turn it for? Is it starting? Is it catching? Do I? Oh no, it hasn't. I'm going to turn it off quickly, pump the throttle, jigger with the choke a bit, do something else. And it's that physical, weighty connection. It's the thing you do. The button press, it just, no, it doesn't do it. So I think, I'm not a Luddite, but I do think there is something about, and there's things I don't like about keys, which is sometimes they're in a position on the car where Neil and I are quite tall. So where the key barrel goes in on the dash, Monkey, you just talk amongst yourself for a moment. You won't know what this is like. You put the key in and your knee hits the key. And I've been in the car where it's almost broken the bloody thing out because my knee's too...
Manish, don't nod. You're about the same height as me. Your knee's been nowhere...
No, Manish, show me that.
So,
when I first saw this, and actually, I've kind of had a bit of a reverse of this. When I first saw the question, apart from the, is it the, you know, dot internet question, I thought, could I be passionate about it? And now I've listened to this debate and thought about it. I can actually be passionate about it because it's that whole thing about, look at those 993 Porsche keys, my very first... You know, huge privilege and good fortune to be able to 25 years ago, I had a 993. You had that key in your hand thinking, that's a Porsche key. And now you see a Porsche key and it just looks like anything else. So, no, I think there's a place for them and we'll cherish them and protect them.
I would love it. That's my favorite key there.
Yeah.
And do you know what? When it's like... dark, when it's dark and you're trying to get in it,
got the little button.
This is very important because you don't know where to put the bloody thing.
Yeah, you scratch stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good key that.
Yeah. But two things. Number one, you mentioned about Range Rovers, Neil, and I was told last week that someone I know has just bought a new Range Rover. He lives outside of London, has an apartment in London, comes in once a week, and he has taken the insurance because he's now bought the car. What do you think the excess is if the car gets stolen in London?
Is the value of the car?
Oh, it's actually not. Well, thanks for that. You could have at least said $2,000 or something like that. But it's 50,000 quid if the car...
50,000?
50,000 quid. Because he's going to street park it in Kensington or somewhere like that. The car's fucking gone. You know, how is it in a world where they're delivering these 150 to 200,000 pound Range Rovers that they can't focus on some form of technology they have... ownership over that you can't get a fucking laptop out. It's ridiculous. And Chris, you've obviously
helps with their sales, Edward.
if that's their strategy, then you know.
Yeah. I think it's actually. I mean, Manish makes a point, but I think it's the other way around. They're beginning to see a problem because the word's getting round. You know, even if you're not into cars, you go to the your kids' fancy school, and someone else goes, "I wouldn't get one of these because they get new."
That's right.
It's definitely doing the rounds.
Yeah.
Yeah, my mate's had three Range Rover Sports nicked off his drive in Wandsworth.
Yeah, I mean, I...
If any of you have got, any of our listeners want to go on and film themselves starting their car, stick it onto your Instagram and tag at Collecting Cars.
That's a really good idea.
We'll share our best ones across the social media. But
that is one of the strangest things I've ever heard because there's something deeply Freudian about plunging the key to the ignition barrel.
That's the bowl again.
I think I know, but I wrote this because I'm with you. I'm with Neil and Chris on this analogy with the smart motorway. The keyless situation does kind of solve a problem that no one's ever really wanted to ask a question about. I've never thought to myself, this key thing doesn't work because it's always been functional and it's operated for me. And the problem with the keyless technology, as I see it, apart from another part of the vehicle becoming de-emotional, is that if it doesn't work every time, it pisses you off. So if and it's always the law of Murphy means the one time you want keyless to work is when it's raining, you've got bags full of shopping or have you, and you go to pull the door and the fucking thing doesn't open. Then you think, I've got to get the key out and flip it. At which point you're thinking, the one time I needed this to work, it doesn't work. And I've only got one vehicle that I know every time I touch the door handle will open, and it's an 08 plate Land Cruiser. All the new stuff I've got, it occasionally doesn't work. And if it doesn't work once, it might as well not work at all. And I think the key also, where I will defend the keyless revolution is that I think the key has for a long time been neglected by car makers. It was something that could have been used as a point of theatre gratification so much more. You think back to Ferraris of the 2000s. They revolutionised what they were doing. They made fantastic cars. They made them out of aluminium. They used to give you this shit red key. It was terrible, blob of plastic. Yeah. Wasn't too much to ask. They might give you a lovely piece of aluminium, or they might have, you know, they might have just done something special with it. It was just so ordinary, I thought. And no car maker was really doing anything with car keys.
But you pull that thread, and then one step later, you're with the good doctor and the emotional control unit.
Yeah, that didn't go well for me. And if we talk about Freudian, plunging that bad boy into the dashboard with, and you had to use both fingers, that wasn't a good look for anyone that was watching you start with Aston Martin. But I do love car keys. And I think that in my head, and we all do this now and again, when I'm running my imaginary car company lying in the bath and the spec of the car, what I call it, I know that I'd really go to town on the car key. And I'd want the car key to be, I wouldn't want to sell the owner a fucking watch with 14, you know, stupid movements in it that you couldn't tell the time. I'd want to present them with a box, and inside I want there to be a thing of absolute beauty that they would just cherish, and it would be a piece of jewellery in its own right. That's what I'd love to do. Pagani.
That was the best thing about the R32 GTR was the titanium key. That fucking titanium key was the... Actually, I didn't like the rest of the car, but I almost kept the key. That's lovely, that key. I know they're like £2 million, those cars now, aren't they?
They are, but and obviously you're wrong about the car, but the key was magnificent.
The key, lovely, that titanium key, yeah.
Right. This was one proposed by Chris Cooper, who is rather good at this stuff. He said, what's your favourite motoring quotation? And I thought to myself, that's quite a good one. Let's do that. I hasten to say, in honour of my English teachers from school, not to say quote, it has to be quotation, because quote is late, lazy. So what is your favourite motoring quotation, Edward Lovett? And to be clear, it can't be you talking. You've got to quote someone more famous than you.
Win on Sunday, sell on Monday.
What else would it be?
Yeah.
Okay.
Who was that Chapman?
I know Ford. I think Ford used it as a marketing campaign in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, that's true.
Manish, what's yours going to be?
I've got a few here, I'm afraid. But, there are two Jean-Marie Blest that I love. Obviously, from Senna, the best decision is my decision, which I think is a great quote. There's another one that he says when he's being interviewed about becoming head of the FIA, and he says, I have nothing against the English except that they burnt Joan of Arc, which I just think is a great...
That is brilliant. I like that.
Senna, who says, F1 is politics and it's money, and when you're young, you have to go through this on being screwed at Monaco in 84, and he works out at the end of his life, actually, you go through this all your life if you're going to be an F1. A Bernie Eccleston quote, which I love, every time he talked about what could happen or what he had to do and whatever argument there was, he says, he always ends it with, and that's exactly what happened.
Just I like that.
Sort of, don't ask me. Yeah.
That's not remotely sinister.
Not at all. But my absolute, there's a slight tangent, but in the film The Italian Job, when Charlie Croker and Camp Freddy have got to get Professor Peach, Benny Hill, they've got to go and see his sister, and played by Irene Handel. And it is literally the greatest scene, I think, in the entire film, very underrated. So both of them have got cats on their laps, and she's talking about Professor Peach, oh, he did do that, oh yeah, oh, he did do that. Yeah. And then there's a non sequitur line, which is just of comic genius, which has never been matched. Camp Freddy starts stroking the cat on its back and its tail comes up. And I'm sure this was improvised. She turns around and goes, oh, you don't want to do that, dear. Give them ideas.
Yeah. That's great. I love that.
Right. So, Chris, what are your seven quotations?
Okay. So I have to say, well, first of all, this was Cameron, my son's Cameron, suggesting it. I came out a load of suggestions. I thought this is a good one. And I have Monkey always says, for God's sake, don't read the comments on YouTube, whatever. So, of course, all of us read all of the comments. And somebody did say, why does Chris Cooper come up with 7 suggestions and one? I'm terribly sorry. I'm going to come up with a few this time. So I really liked talking about smart motorways and the car keys. Henry Ford, when he said, if I'd asked my customers what they wanted, they'd have said a faster horse. There's a whole discussion in there about actually the leadership needed from the car industry to get stuff right. We'll come back to that another time. So actually, so Cameron's suggestions, his own question were, and they are from the land of horsepower and the big engine. Harold Shelby, too much power is just enough. There is never enough horsepower, just not enough traction. But his favorite and mine was Mark Donohue, who he would know because he used to drive that 91730, the most powerful racing car ever run on the circuit.
Horsepower.
And he said, Mark Donohue said, if you can leave 2 black stripes from the exit of one corner to the braking zone of the next, you have enough horsepower. That's my favorite. So well done, Cam.
Yeah, okay. Well, we're going to go to Edward Lovett.
No, I've done mine.
Oh, you've done yours. Sorry. Neil Clifford.
Do you want another one? I didn't give you 7. I thought it was 1 each, but it's obviously 7. I've got more.
No. We've escaped with you, Lovett, so we've done all right. Go on, Neil Clifford.
Okay, I've got one from the King of Italy. We don't sell cars, we sell dreams.
Yeah.
We are Italy's national team. There are many great soccer teams in this country, but there is only one Ferrari.
Yeah.
I think that was in the 1950s. That was the first mic drop recorded, isn't it? That was
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I've gone for a bit of a cliche. I'm really surprised. It's one of those moments where I thought that one of you guys would say what I was about to say, and I was dreading the fact that I'd have to
I was paranoid about that.
Another one. So mine is, I love the Ferry Porsche one, which is the last car built on Earth will surely be a sports car.
Yeah,
so it's a lovely summary of how I think we all feel about motor vehicles. And yeah. The other one is not actually a quotation, it's the title of a book that I didn't think, the author of which I didn't think would get mentioned here, but Chris Cooper has just mentioned it. I still think the greatest sporting biography of them all, not just motorsport biography, but greatest sporting biography is Mark Donohue's book. And it's simply titled The Unfair Advantage.
Yeah.
I think no phrase better describes motorsport to me than the phrase The Unfair Advantage. Because that when you watch Manish's wonderful program, Lucky, and you see these young figures, the Frank Williamses, the Bernie Ecclestons, they are scurrying around trying to locate the unfair advantage.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Right. I think we've done quite a bit there, guys. I'm just going to, I want to just mention before we do our Muzak choices, that if you go online onto the site, we don't often do this, but I'm pushing you towards collecting cars because we've got a collection of fast Fords on there. I've driven them, done a little video, and they really were gorgeous. And they reminded me that car collections don't need to be exotica. They don't need to be expensive and Italian and low slung. You can sometimes end up in a shed that's pure Essex and find yourself loving them. So go and have a look at that video and go and bid on a Fiesta 1.3 gear because you might be surprised at how much money they're worth.
Is it Mark 1?
It's a Mark 1.
I love that shape.
Pretty car.
And also there's a brochure in there. There's the monthly Ford brochures for about 4 years. I mean, the expense, every single option price for every single model was listed every month.
I used to read all of that.
I know.
Yep. Every month, go and get from the local Ford dealer. God, how
you can, and it's so logical, so well
written. Yeah, I know.
You can basically go down and say, right, how much were headrests on a 1.3 Fiesta? And it'll go £24.27. There, done.
Passenger wing mirror.
Yeah. So I don't often do a sales pitch, but there's my sales pitch for this week.
And they'll be going live as of this Friday, the 12th, and ending on the 21st.
Buy yourself some Essex.
You can easily get your 2-car garage with that.
Oh, yeah. Sugar, the 2-car garage. There you go.
Yeah, there's a link.
When you've got the alert, you're not really thinking, are you? The 2-car garage. Let me read this out. Here we go. Using my telephone here. I apologize. Oh, we're on the piss now. Here we go. It's 1995, and you have somehow had your lucky numbers roll in. The winnings aren't life-altering, but you now have £100,000 to buy a new sports car for yourself and an estate car, family wheels, for your better half. which you were still allowed to say in 1995. The only spanner in the works is that you've always told anyone who would listen that you could never own a 911, which makes this a whole lot more difficult, I think. Let's start with Edward, I was only allowed one quotation. Love it.
Do you want another one? So I've ordered a 355 GTB manual.
How much was that?
£87,000.
Ooh. Ooh.
And I did write this down last night. I wanted it in blue Le Mans with the Koyo seats and racing seats. But I think as a lottery purchase,
yeah,
it's probably your first Ferrari. And your first Ferrari's got to be Rosso Corsa.
Yeah.
So I'm going to change it to red because that's more suitable. And then I was going to come up with some silly... I've been trying to find what was the fastest growing business stock in 1995 that my newly acquired financial advisor got me to invest in once the lottery payout so I could inflate my budget and buy an Audi RS2. But then I reread the quote this morning and you put for the better half. So it wasn't really a car for me to drive. So some sort of affordable BMW estate car with my remaining £12,000, I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm. Am I allowed to go second? Only because I never
thought... Of course you can.
I never thought that Edward and I would derive from the same basic fetal cell. I mean, just look, how is that actually possible? Last week, it's the same Rowley as me. Okay, I think, should we just do a Rorschach test or something, just to see if we, literally
separation
put down a Ferrari F355, which I converted from the dollars to the pounds at that time, and actually came to 74. So I don't know.
Okay. Cheaper, it's about, yeah.
And the BMW 3 Series Touring E36, which you could just pick up for £26,000.
Oh, a 328
BMW. No, not the 328. No.
Could you not afford that?
No. That was too expensive. No.
Good engine, that. Good engine.
No, it was a 320, actually. You could get that for £26,000 pretty well.
Black with saffron.
There we go.
I believe we picked the same cars, Edward.
Okay. So, can I go next?
No, I want Neil Clifford to go next in the hope that he might steal the car that you were about to say.
Mine's going to be much better. Right, so I'm not allowed a 911, but of course, I'm still allowed a Porsche.
Oh, God.
So I go up to Dick Lovett, 928 GTS manual, the last of the 928. Of course, the 911 replacement was the strategy. It's the same bloke who did the bloody smart motorways. So oak green metallic, tan leather. Fantastic thing. And then I'm like, oh, I've got a bit of money left here. And I didn't really look at the price of what they probably like 60 odd grand or something, 928. And I won over £1 million. So I actually bought a house in Sicily as well. So I go over to the Palermo BMW dealership because they're only available in left-hand drive. I bought an E34 M5 Touring.
Ooh.
And they're cheaper over
sneaky,
there.
Because you can... Sneaky little bespectacled bastard.
Double sunroof in Calypso red, ooh, deep back. Cloth, air conditioned cloth.
I'm about to have a moment here, boys.
M cloth, D badge, that dark calypso red, twin sunroof, air conditioning out of the Palermo BMW dealership. My wife won't want to drive it because it's left hand drive and super scary, but you don't give a fuck anyway. You buy that Fiesta on collecting cars. And the amazing thing about those two cars, you keep them 30 years and you've lost nothing. There's no depreciation. You're going to get your money back.
I think Chris Cooper, I feel sorry for you now, Chris. That's quite some pairing to follow.
So the reason why I said I'll go next is because my list was a Ferrari 355 GTB and a BMW 320i Touring.
I knew it last night. I thought, how can we not all have these?
Because, I'll tell you why. Because in 1995, I distinctly remember when, I remember Chris Evans being interviewed Sorry, Mikey, that'll trigger you.
Yeah.
I remember Chris Evans being interviewed by, or speaking to somebody on the radio about what's the best car in 1995. And whoever's talking to you said, well, it's obvious. And it was what anyone ever talked about in 95 was, it's a Ferrari 355, because it was so much better than the 348 and 328 and everything went before. It just completely changed. Luca's first Berlinetta, probably. So if you were 1995, you just won a little bit on the lottery, and you asked anybody what to buy, they'd all say buy a 355. And that was about 80. I mean, the 100,000 only works if you put no options on it, which even in 95, I suspect nobody did. And trying to find price lists for stuff in 1995 is surprisingly difficult. Quite a few people on eBay had 1995 BMW price lists, but I was tempted to phone them up to say, could you fax it for me? I'll still give you the money, but it's complicated. So I reckon through a process of extrapolation from various markets in Europe and the US and a bit of the Bank of England inflation calculator, you could just get a 320i in cloth, standard alloys, and the 355, no extras, for 100 grand in 95.
Yeah. What color would yours have been?
I think if you won the lottery in 95, you'd have to go for red. I would go red over black. If you're going to have the first red car, it's got to be a red car.
Yeah.
I realized that by taking the 911 off the table, I've made this a lot more difficult than it needs to be. And it just reminds us how much we love 911s, because I've just written down, you could have bought a 993 GT2 within your budget. anyway, so I've gone Italian, but there was a car that, and I've just squeaked in here, that was launched in the, I think, December of that year, was the Maserati Ghibli Cup. And I just, they really captured my imagination. You know, I remember Harry had one in the Performance Car magazine. And you could also get that crazy Italian one that had the 2 liter absolute.
Oh, the tax break one. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think one of those in that very, they did a very dark metallic blue, almost with a hint of purple in it. I love that. The family car is interesting because the Fast Estate wasn't that common a thing then. You know, they were quite quick estates. The M5 was the only really fast estate. You could go to AMG and they'd hot you up and do you an AMG, what they called a 36 then, which 3.6 to inline six, but it was a heavy thing. It wasn't that quick. And actually my family had a car then that was the most practical car I've ever used. And it was really, really fast. It was a Renault Espace V6. And that's what I'd have. I loved that Espace because you could take the seats out, take all five seats out, and really you had a piece of plastic that had 160 horsepower and it would do 140 miles an hour. And with the rest of the money, I'd just stock up on an exceptional seller, I think. I'd have lots of money left over. So it'd be, for me, Renault Espace, Maserati Ghibli Cup. I mean, if you wrote those on paper, how many breakdowns would you suffer in the first year? It would just be tragic, wouldn't it? And I realised that I shouldn't pose these two car challenges anymore, because I've left three of our panel here being forced to choose the same cars, which means I've not done a good job there. I do apologise.
Well, I think you'd end up with the 355. If you were a lottery winner in 95, lottery started in 94.
Yeah.
If you were fortunate enough to win the lottery in 95 and you thought, I was going to buy a dream car, I think you'd end up with a 355. We're old enough to remember how exotic and exciting and unbelievable it seemed. I don't think you'd, only very, very odd people like us potentially would have thought a 993 GT2.
When did GoldenEye come out?
95.
Well, the spider. No, that was a spider, wasn't it? Driving GTS. Down the hill.
The GTS.
Was it GTS, was it?
But where it was having an honest dice with a DB5, which.
Yeah, right.
It's in there. But
what was her name? It was something like Xenia on the top.
On the top. Xenia on the top.
Yeah.
She used to have orgasms as she strangled people with her thighs.
Yes. She had a small crisis, I think, is what we're trying to say, Chris.
Sorry, I do apologise. Yeah, I thought she was having the big O. Right, let's move on to some music. And before we do that, I want to say thank you to Neil Clipper for being here at 5 a.m. New York time, to Edward Lovett for being here at 12:19 Epinay time, and the other three of us being in the UK. I'm going to go first this week. I've just changed mine at the last minute. I was listening to Appetite for Destruction this week, and I still maintain it's one of the best rock albums ever written. I absolutely love it. Guns N' Roses, Mr. Brownstone, it always gets me going. But I've just got this sense. I'm going to go drive up to Cheltenham and see my kids later on, and I want a happy song. Sometimes I like to get in the car and just be made happy. And for me, the Buggles' Video Killed the Radio.
Oh, what a song.
It's just, it just makes
me horn.
So there you go. For me, it's the Buggles this week.
It makes me quiver with, that's a brilliant song, that. Song on MTV.
Neil?
If I don't sing in cars, I like to drum, which, of course, is slightly more, it's slightly more dangerous than singing, but nevertheless...
Are you two index fingers, or are you more...
No, I'm holding the sticks.
Okay.
Okay. Good luck, everyone.
Clearly not. I wonder why I'm such a bad driver. Maybe it's because I'm drumming. and because I'm in America, I had to think about what is a great American song to drum, and it's Red Hot Chili Peppers, Californication.
Oh, great song.
Great song.
Super good great drumming song. Yeah.
Yeah. Edward Lovett.
I'm not sure. I thought I'd listed this one, but I looked in the playlist and we haven't put it. But Type 7 did a video with Philip Cadore's 911 rally car, which Richard Tuttle was driving. Go onto YouTube, Google Type 7 Safari 911. And I think
it's called Shakedown.
It's called The Shakedown. Yeah, it's bloody brilliant. And it just makes you want a safari car in a field right this moment. Anyway, the song in that is Velvet Sky of Dreams. Very good, but great video. Go watch it.
Manish, are we going classical or are we going modern?
Oh, we're going somewhere in between. We are off to Italy next week. One of my favourite films that touches everything is The Talented Mr. Ripley. And I don't know how you cannot love that film. And there's a piece of music that wasn't in the film, but which I always imagine is in the film. And it's when they go to their jazz bars and when they really genuinely get lost in Italy. And I think that's when Ripley really falls in love with, what's his name? The Jude Law character, the baddie goody baddie. And I always imagine that to Nina Simone's I Put a Spell on You, which I think is the sexiest, loveliest, most beautiful piece of music. I could just imagine driving in Rome or in Bologna or something like that, in a Ferrari, listening to that.
Chris Cooper, follow that.
So under the heading of what makes you happy and feel good, and I just happened to randomly trip across it last night, the Doobie Brothers' What a Fool Believes. It's just got that wonderfully uplifting opening piano, and it's just that voice, those voices they had. So Doobie Brothers, What a Fool Believes, such a nice, summery, feel good, just get outside and drive.
Edward Lovett, where's this playlist? Where does it exist?
Collecting Addicts on Spotify.
There you go. Thank you very much to Neil Clifford, Edward Lovett, Manish Pandey, Chris Cooper for putting up with me again this week. We'll be back again, hopefully next week, hopefully in the UK, all of us. Actually, no, we won't, will we? Manish and I will be in Italy. So we'll have to find a way of dialing in. We haven't thought about that. Enjoy your driving, stay safe, and we'll see you next week.